The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Is Totally 80s, the podcast dedicated to the music of the greatest decade ever. So turn up your Walkman, loosen that scrunchie, and get ready to talk 80s with your host, Lindsay Parker.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Parker from Yahoo Entertainment and Sirius XM Volume, and welcome to another fabulous episode of Totally 80s. We love hearing from you, so why not take a second to follow us at Totally 80s on Facebook and Instagram, or email us your comments and show ideas to podcast@totally80s.com. And just a reminder, if you want to see our faces, and when you find out who the guest we have is today, you'll absolutely want to see his face. You can catch this episode on video as well on our Totally 80s YouTube channel, so go check that out. So first, joining me today, as always, is my partner in all things 80s, John Hughes.
Hey, Lindsay.
So our special guest today is someone who I think has had more comebacks and reinventions in show business than almost anyone I could think of. He is a musician, actor, and radio personality who's been entertaining us since the 1970s. He also toured with another supergroup, The Power Station, replacing Robert Palmer, most notably at Live Aid, which was the first time you ever performed with Power Station, which is kind of insane. In addition to all that, if you didn't think that was enough, his acting credits include spots on Melrose Place, Seinfeld, Roseanne, Miami Vice, Northern Exposure, as well as countless voiceover credits. And you may remember when he reinvented himself to portray Murdoch, the arch nemesis of MacGyver, for the series of that same name. And if that wasn't enough, on top of all that, he currently is a DJ on Little Steven's Underground Garage every weekday from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. Pacific on Sirius XM. But we, of course, here at Totally 80s, know and love him best as the man who, along with Holly Knight, co-wrote Ann Emotion's amazing top 10 80s hit, Obsession. Along, of course, with portraying the lead singer of the immortal punk band Scum of the Earth on an immortal episode of WKRP in Cincinnati. So that is why the Marquis himself is here today to talk about the biggest comeback stories of the 1980s. And without further ado, we are very happy to welcome to Totally 80s, the Marquis, Michael DeBar.
Boy, I got to go back to the Power Station for a second.
Why not?
The production on the For Power Station record. Remember the first time you heard the drum intro to Some Like It Hot on the radio?
Yes.
Go Lens. I do remember.
I remember it very. Yeah, because it definitely, obviously, I mean, this isn't a comeback. This is Duran Duran had definitely some comebacks later on in the 80s and 2000s. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, yeah. In the 90s and 2000s. But the fact that Duran, I would actually call Notorious a slight comeback. Hear me out. Follow my train of thought. Duran Duran were like the biggest band in 1983, 1984. The fact that they took time off at the peak of their commercial fame to do two different side projects, Power Station and Arcadia, both of which were successful. But then when they came back, they had lost two of the Taylors, two key members. They were no longer the Fab Five. And then they also changed their sound to be a little more silky R&B style, which was, you know, with Niall's help. And then they had hits that way. And then they just, you know, Duran Duran's, you know, career has had many highs and lows. If we're getting into the 90s, I would think one of the biggest comebacks of all time is when Duran Duran did Ordinary World and Come Undone on the Wedding album and suddenly had two top five hits again. No, I don't think anyone saw that coming. Everyone absolutely thought Duran Duran were done. And there's been many times that people have thought Duran Duran were done. Ah, you have little faith. Duran Duran will never be done. Don't you know? I cannot wait for Future Past to come out, their album that they have with Giorgio Moroder and Graham Coxon. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. The fact that they took such a huge risk, Duran Duran, to like not follow up Seven the Ragged Tiger with another album with the five people. And they said, oh, we're going to do this weird Arcadia record, which was like a super expensive record with Grace Jones and like David Gilmour and people like that. And then Power Station, this epic rock and soul record that, you know, later you got to have on stage, Michael, and interpret the songs. I mean, that's an interesting story in and of itself right there.
Well, Notorious Dial's all over that record. Without Nile Rodgers on that record, you would not have a single like Skin Trade where Simon is doing his best Prince impersonation and it makes the top 40. What? Or a song like Meet El Presidente with the Latin Rascals. So I don't think Nick and Simon were sitting in the corner going, hey, we should do a Prince motif here. I think that's really Nile.
Yeah, yeah. But what was it like for you, Michael, when you reinvented yourself as the lead singer of Power Station at Live Aid and got to do, and actually sort of in line with what I was just talking about, that was the last time the Fab Five, the original Duran Duran lineup, played live for 17, 18 years. You were there to witness that fracturing, but you were also there to sort of reinvent yourself, stepping into Robert Palmer's shoes in front of, I don't know, 5 million people. I don't know. I don't know how many people were watching it.
2 billion.
Well,
I brought my own shoes.
Well, you know, you're self-managing and you're self-styling.
Well, I did bring my own shoes. I can't sing like Robert Palmer. He's Marvin Gaye. I'm Steve Marriott. You know, it's a different world. But I adored Robert 10 years prior to the Power Station. I knew him very well. We got drunk together wherever we saw each other. And I adored him. And I think he's a brilliant artist. But I didn't go into that project, you know, with a view of like reproducing what he did. I couldn't. You know, he sang in a whole different vibe and key. And, you know, plus, I had to learn 30 songs in 20 minutes, you know, and which I did. Something like it. Got it. Okay.
Didn't you say you only rehearsed with them once? Did you mean that literally?
Oh, no. I did not. It wasn't just once. It was 3 days.
Oh, okay.
Which is 3 days. And we did a 3-hour show, you know. But no, but the point is that the record I thought was great. You know, I thought it was a fantastic sounding record. I couldn't believe Tony Thompson. Andy was a rock and roll guitar player, so we really stuck together. John is the most beautiful, sensitive, lovely, you know, coke addict at the time, and I adored him. And you know, it was funky, man. You know, it was funky. It was these young kids. What were they? 22. Lindsay, right? Something like that.
Not much. If right. they were older than that, so it wasn't by much.
I was 122 at that time. So, you know, it was a different vibe. I was sober. In fact, John and Andy did become sober because of yours truly. That's a fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, they're using coke and you know, they don't not enjoying their lives and they're on top of the world. And, you know, and it's interesting because I'd been sober about 5 years, but 4 years by then. And I remember, you know, I had a very strict thing. I would go running with the bodyguards and I would do what I would work out and they'd see this. They've been up for 3 days. It looked like hell. John was, you know, shall we say, not the slender beauty that he, you know, was prior and he is now. Mm-hmm. And Andy was like rock and roll and, you know, going into that vibe as opposed to the strict discipline of Duran Duran's motif, which he had to be a part of a band when Andy really just wanted to be Jimmy Page, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on there. It's a story. It's a hell of a story. Me, I just kept my eye on the prize and the bank account.
Interesting. So I want to go back. We've been talking a lot about bands that maybe like their heyday was in the 70s and then they reinvented themselves in the 80s. But I want to go a little bit further back into bands that were more identified with the 60s. And again, with the help of MTV, had a comeback. And the Kinks, Come Dancing. Which was interesting that was such an MTV hit because it was so much referencing, like the theme of that video and the song was much about the pally, was much about this by, you know.
British, very British.
Super British. And also what Ray Davies does so well is this nostalgia for like war, you know, 40s, post-war Britain, 50s. I mean, I didn't know what this whole like phenomenon of going to dancing, these kind of, you know, like quaint dance halls were and in London in the 50s. But MTV played the hell out of Come Dancing.
And it was so hooky, wasn't it, though? I mean, it was such a hook. It was so commercial.
Rinky. Yeah. But
yeah, it was wonderful.
I mean, I guess they reinvented themselves a couple times in the 70s. They
many times. But you went from You Really Got Me to the, you know, Village Green Preservation Society, you know, which is an opera and it's an extraordinary work. Raymond Davis, Waterloo Sunset is the anthem of British rock and roll. I mean, that is the greatest song ever. I just did a whole thing on them on my show, The Kinks. The Kinks changed because they couldn't come to America. This was the problem. They had the drug bust. They couldn't come to America at the height of their fame. Dave Cockfight was kicking ass, Hermits, all these, you know, and the Kinks were back at home going, you know, they couldn't make it out there, man. You know, so it's been up and down for Ray and Dave, and Dave having to deal with Jimmy Page played the solo on You Really Got Me, and it's, you know, and he's had to deal with all that. It's a very difficult vibe for the Kinks. The Kinks had a rough time, and Sir Raymond got knighted.
Do you think that, you know, there's been rumors forever that the Davies brothers are going to reunite?
I know, year after year, you know, and we keep track of that because Stephen Van Zandt is very, very, you know, he adores them, as we all do. Brilliant. Ray is one of the great, great writers, the Oscar Wilde of rock and roll, you know, in many ways. But I don't know if they'd ever get together. You know, they are 120 now, so...
122. But Ray actually was all over MTV for another reason, was because he was, you know, with Chrissy Hynde, who was like a darling of MTV. I actually remember this. This is kind of funny. You might remember this, John. When, I guess, you know, she'd obviously, Chrissy Hynde and Ray had been together for a while. They obviously had a child together. They broke into on MTV like a breaking news, like a news bulletin, the kind of like urgent, this just in, we're stopping regular programming to say that Chrissy Hynde had married Jim Kerr from Simple Minds because their romance was kind of a whirlwind. And I think maybe people didn't even realize she wasn't with Ray anymore. And suddenly she was marrying Jim instead. Like that, it was such big news that she was marrying someone that wasn't Ray Davies.
Yeah.
That they like were like, stop the Duran Duran video. We're just playing like news bulletin, news flash.
Stop your subbing is what they were doing. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously, yeah, the Pretenders, that video, the cover of the Kink song, that was on MTV a lot. But, you know, the fact that Ray Davies, I'd completely discovered the Kinks from MTV, which is kind of embarrassing to say. But, you know,
I'm with you, Lindsay. I'm ashamed to say that Come Dancing is the first time I put the Kinks with a song.
You know, God. Holy shit.
I'm very ashamed. Of course, I knew Lola when I was a kid. I heard that.
Date Lola?
I did not date her.
Okay.
I did not date them.
Well said.
I don't date them. Boy, that's a great t-shirt.
Exactly.
Dangerous t-shirt, but.
Yeah, you know. Well, you know, it's rock. the Kinks were interesting. I got to tell you guys, the most depressing thing I can tell you about the Kinks is I was playing Come Dancing at work when we were still in an office, and a younger member of staff comes by and hears it and goes, is this the new Blur single?
I mean, it's depressing and yet kind of flattering.
Yeah.
And kind of, for someone who had no knowledge of it, kind of astute, that because obviously the Blur, who are like, again, like I said about the Kinks, like super British themes, British, you know, that's why the Blur were never as big here as Gorillaz were. I could understand why someone, I mean, I know you're saying it's depressing that like the person didn't recognize the song, but I think that's actually a pretty astute comment for a young person to make. That
very much so. Super English. Also understanding what the British rock and roll system was, you know, writing about, you know, the tube. You know what I mean? You know, Ode to a Tube by Blur. You know, Damon Albarn. Amazing. They were Kinksy. They love the Kinks. Everybody loves the Kinks. I mean, the guy that wrote songs that are genius, you know. Rodgers and Hammerstein, rock and roll, right there.
That fourth Blur album is a Kinks album, basically.
Yeah.
The greatest.
Well, since we're on the subject of, like I said, 60s artists that received a comeback from MTV, John Hughes, how much time do you have? Because, I mean, I can't believe we've gone this long and haven't talked about the Monkees yet.
Oh, well, crap.
I mean, the Monkees... correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the resident Monkees expert on this panel. So obviously what we
I am a Monkees fanatic. How dare you?
This is, well, yes, but John has worked with the Monkees, is my point. So in 1986.
Let Michael talk.
No, I just want to ask you real quick, John. So am I correct that when MTV played that Monkees marathon in 1986, which reinstated all this excitement over the Monkees because, you know, all the kids were watching MTV at the time. Did the Monkees, they were quite officially broken up, right? They literally reunited because of this.
Here's the thing about the Monkees. The Monkees were four individuals that were contractually obligated to a TV show. Anything after that was gravy. So they never had any management. They never had any central person pulling them together. It was always a promoter or someone from the outside saying, why don't you guys get together and do this? And then he had to make four separate deals. So MTV happens out of nowhere. The show was in syndication, but it wasn't like it was in the 70s in syndication. And they do this 24-hour marathon. And this promoter, this concert promoter gets a great idea. Hey, I have this Herman's Hermits thing coming up again, Michael. Why don't I put the Monkees on the same bill and do a Shed tour? So he gets a lot of credit for pulling the three minus Michael together. And that's what started this whole thing. Arista, smelling cash in the air, puts out this compilation record, comes to the three Monkees and says, why don't you do two new songs to put on this compilation record? They can't make a deal with Davey because Davey was Davey. And so Peter and Mickey do That Was Then, This Is Now, shocking everyone by getting into the top 20. What? In 1986? So it's always been like that with the Monkees. Somebody has to come to them and say, why don't you guys do this?
Interesting. But that, I mean, the fact that they were pretty much a non-entity, that they were not touring, they were not recording. And the fact that, do you have any insight, John, as to why MTV decided to even do a 24, to relinquish 24 hours of their weekend programming to this, at the time, 20-year-old TV show?
It was a test. They were growing, but the growth had plateaued. People were watching in 3 to 5 minute increments, which sucks for Nielsen's. And for, you know, they were able to go to advertisers with the demographic data and say, look, it's the youngest, spendiest audience you're going to get on cable, but it still wasn't enough. So it was a test to see if they could hold viewers for a sustained amount of time. Because right after that, you see things like Remote Control, the game show premiere, The Real World, you know, half hour segments, as opposed to music video, music video, music video. Mm. So it was an experiment. And this was a way that to do it that really surprised them. I don't think anybody expected it.
And it was a real full circle thing, because not only was obviously Michael Nesmith very instrumental to the origin story of MTV, his Pop Clip show was kind of the template for what MTV was. He actually was asked to be an executive on MTV and turned that down. But I would go so far as to say, I've said this many times, that what they called on the Monkees, Mickey Dolenz calls it a romp, which was like those vignettes where they would play the entire Monkees song for the week and they'd show them, you know, on some caper or like running on a beach or whatever. Those were music videos. Those were early music videos.
Production called them romps.
Okay.
They would film, sometimes they would film several romps in a day to insert into other episodes. You know, the famous Rainbow Room where they're doing Daydream Believer with the rainbow background. That was one of several songs that were filmed during a tour stop in Chicago. They found a studio with that scrim and they just did a whole bunch of stuff. So yeah, they kind of, I would give the Beatles credit for inventing that. You know, it was
Hard Day's Night. Yeah.
Be honest, you know, it was a riff on Hard Day's
Night.
But
on television.
On US TV for sure.
Everything was a riff on the Beatles.
Exactly.
That's
for the Monkees. Hello.
And they will be the first ones to tell you, by the way, the Monkees.
Right. A Hard Day's Night is John Lennon's birthday today.
Michael, you said you're a huge Monkees fan too. Do you have any thoughts about this, like, kind of, like, I'll use the word bizarre, like, just this comeback no one...
Well, to me, it's obvious. I mean, the shows were MTV 20 years before. Yeah, I mean, they were all the sketches and jumping up and down and Hard Day's Nighting, you know, and of course it's MTV. I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Did you know them? Did you know the Monkees back in the day?
I know Talk, you know, I knew him, you know, and I loved him. And the funny thing about Peter Talk, it's interesting. The whole Los Angeles, Laurel Canyon mythology, Talk was the king of Laurel Canyon. He put everybody together. It wasn't, the whole thing about the Monkees, and people think they were laughed at by the musicians, absolutely incorrect. Nesmith is a fucking genius. Talk, brilliant. You know, Mickey sang his ass off. Davey, superstar, gorgeous, great hair. You know, I mean, fuck them all. The Monkees were great. The Monkees were really a terrific rock and roll band. I loved them. The reason they were on MTV is because they did it 20 years later. Bert Rafelson, he knew what time it was. Let's get an American Beatles. I mean, it's not a shock. They copied the bit, you know, it's obvious, you know, like, you know, except they didn't talk like this, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. But I loved them, and Talk was brilliant. Guy, super smart. You loved music, folk, Americana. That's where he was at, you know.
Going back to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing, it pisses me off to no end that they have never been nominated.
Incredible.
And I fear that the window for them to get nominated and inducted has kind of closed, because the Hall has kind of moved on to nominating bands from the 80s and 90s now, and isn't really, it certainly isn't looking at six. Basically, I have had some intel that I've heard from people in the industry that if you are a band whose heyday or origin time was the 60s, and you haven't been nominated yet, you're probably not going.
Joe Cocker, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, exactly.
Joe Cocker is not in the Rock and Roll.
That's crazy.
But it just makes it so we all know it's ludicrous, don't we?
Yes.
I mean, it is. So, but if they're going to do it, they should do it right. I do want to ask both of you guys, though, in terms going back to this 1986 comeback that the Monkees had, which then sort of kind of got the ball rolling for multiple comebacks that they've had over the years, including like the Good Times record that came out a couple years ago that John, I know you
But there's a
on.
Record out now, Lindsay. There's a record just dropped with Nesmith and Mickey. It's incredible. It's absolutely beautiful. It's like an opera. And the son, Michael's son.
Are you talking about like Dolan Sings Nesmith?
Yes. No, that's not the title. I think that they have a title. I can't remember it. But Chris Nesmith, the son, produced this record. And it's like Beatle India, you know, sitars, tablas.
Okay. John, right? Can you tell me more about that one?
Yeah, it's Mickey covering all Nez songs and reinventing them, and different drum becomes, like Michael says, this Indian influenced, amazing psychedelic trip. Christian Nesmith is a brilliant producer. I had him do some B-sides and some album tracks on the Christmas record that we did a few years ago as well. Wow. And if you guys have not heard Dolan Sings Nesmith, I think you should check it out. The cover is a nod to Nielsen Sings Newman. If you're really a Monkees fan, you know what that all means. But, you know, you've got this entity, the Monkees, that will not die. And to go to your point about the Rock Hall, Lindsay, if it was going to happen, it was going to happen in 2016.
It's a shame.
50th anniversary, new album in the top 15. Ben Gibbard.
Who was involved in that record from Good Times? It was like Noel Gallagher, Paul Weller, and Adam the late great Adam Schlesinger, Andy Partridge from XTC,
Rivers Cuomo, yours truly, you know,
awesome. John Hughes. If you can't get him into the Hall of Fame, who can? But to go back to the just to tie a bow on the whole fact that this kind of all started again in 1986, do you think that particular comeback, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame aside, like, do you think that helped sort of get people aware of the musicianship and the influence, as Michael was talking about, that like did that kind of critical respect eluded them at that time?
Yes.
Well, from critics. Yeah. I mean, but I get more mail when I play the Monkees on my show than any band.
Yep. Really?
The Monkees are hugely popular. Social media adore the Monkees. Jan Wenner, you know, he can go, I don't know, just to kiss Wyman's ass, you know, whatever. but it's the Monkees, baby. Well, everybody loves the Monkees.
Here's the thing that I think is interesting. So John Sykes has replaced Jan Wenner as the guy who oversees the hall, right?
Sykes, but it sucks, you know.
But Sykes was very involved in the early days of MTV, and I hypothesize, at least, you know, this is just my theory, that, you know, the Go-Go's are getting in this year, and they got in their first nomination, but their nomination was very overdue. And a lot of people have said that a lot of the 80s bands that were big on MTV, like Duran Duran, who've never been nominated, maybe now have more of a chance with John at the helm. Well, as we just said, you know, look at how important the Monkees were to MTV in the 80s. Maybe John will put in a word. John Sykes, that is. We know John Hughes will put in a word, but like,
I always do.
We'll see.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
One, for better or worse, the Beach Boys, Kokomo Cocktail soundtrack. Not their best work, but it was a huge, huge hit without Brian Wilson. How do we feel about the Kokomo phenomenon?
All credit to John Stamos.
Okay, fair enough.
Why is he living?
You know, you're absolutely right. You know, you're absolutely right. He being an iconic figure at that time, you know, there's no question about it, but it wasn't a Beach Boys record.
Nope. Yeah, but it was, you know, it was a hit for them. So, you know, good for them.
It was a hit. It wasn't a Beach Boy record.
more excitingly, or more, you know, credibly for me at least, was the whole Roy Orbison phenomenon of the 80s. You know, not only was You Got It a big hit, there was the Traveling Wilburys, well, even like Van Halen cover.
Yeah, it was all about Dylan and all of that.
No,
you know.
No, I wouldn't say that because, like,
you George got it was, Harrison, Tom Petty, and Bob Dylan saying they love Roy Orbison made Roy Orbison be loved.
But there were other stars aligning, like even Van Halen covering Pretty Woman, even there being a movie called Pretty Woman that was the theme song of, and that was like the biggest movie of that year, and it made Julia Roberts an absolute star, and that was Roy Orbison reference. Like, there were just some kind of, there was something in the water. I'm not discounting what you just said, Michael, but it even went beyond that. Just like all of a sudden everyone was talking about Roy Orbison. Like, I don't, John, do you have any insight as to like why all these stars were aligning for him?
I don't have any insight to that. I just am, I want to give props to Virgin Records for having the vision. I mean, who's going to sign Roy Orbison in 1988 and spend money on an Anton Corbijn directed video? And, you know, whoever the A&R guy and was running the label at the time, props, dude. Bono was sniffing around in that documentary, you know?
He's in every documentary. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Okay, so maybe that's meaningless.
What's the name of the artist? What's the name of the artist? Billy? Billy is one of the most unbelievable vocalists I've ever seen in my entire life. I think it's the best show I ever saw. Never saw him.
Why isn't he in your documentary? What do you want me to be?
I said, whatever you do, don't have Bono.
Okay, fair enough.
But yeah, I mean, it's funny. He's kind of someone that was unsung for two decades.
Greatest singer ever.
Yeah. You know, big in the 50s, early 60s, and then just kind of was on the tour circuit, the fairground circuit for a long time. And whoever, like Tina Turner, whoever had that vision and said, this guy will have a hit in 1988, probably had a really rough fight with everybody else at the label to get it through.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It was gratifying that it came so late. You know, at the very tail end of Roy's life, that he was able to have, like, kind of go out with a bang, so to speak. Like, he basically was as big a star as he'd ever been at the end of his life.
Lindsay, I can't believe we haven't mentioned one of your favorites. What survives after the nuclear war? Cockroaches and?
Beatles.
Cher.
Cher, I feel Cher was more of a 90s comeback. Well, she definitely was an 80s comeback artist in terms of her, acting career, Moonstruck and so many big hits.
Someone was the 80s.
Was yes. Turn Back Time the 80s?
The Turn Back Time was 89.
See, she's had so many comebacks, I've lost track. Because if you ask me what was the biggest comeback for Cher, I would say, you know, 98 with Believe, where she became like the oldest woman to ever have a top 40 hit. But you're right, she had comebacks with Turn Back Time, and I Found Someone. And also the fact that, you know, she became an Oscar-winning actress and, like, you know, come back to the, I mean, was it come back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean that sort of, like, got her, all of a sudden she was one of these singers who suddenly was, like, a credible actress. And then there was Silkwood and Mask. And all of a sudden she was, like, Meryl Streep, pretty much. And then she, you're right. I'm sorry that I kind of think of her comeback as being a 90s, but I think, To the point, don't call it a comeback. She's been here for years. She, like, just all, whenever you ever just think, you know, her best days are behind her, her best career days are behind her, it's not true. Yeah.
There's a clip of her on American Bandstand in 1982, and Dick Clark's interviewing her, and she just put out a new wave record called I Paralyze, which I
Like. We've talked about this. That wasn't the reinvention. That was not one of her better comebacks.
Right. But he's interviewing her, and he's like, are you going on tour? What are you doing? She goes, well, you know, I'm actually going to do a little acting. I'm going to be in a little movie called Silkwood. It's got Meryl Streep in it. And the crowd starts laughing.
Like, they think it's funny that she's trying to do this.
Yeah, and it's kind of sad, and it's kind of like, fuck you. Look what happened. It's amazing. So, you know, Cher is right up there, man, when it comes to just constant reinvention. Yeah. Never counter out.
Vegas. Never.
Yes.
Michael, have you, in your acting and musical travails, have you ever encountered or are you, have, do you know Cher? I feel like you're someone that would know Cher.
Yes, I went to a house in Malibu. I was taken there by a close friend of Cher's, and I went over there and spent the afternoon there. I think the other girl was trying to set me up with Cher. That's what I think.
Oh my God, that would have been such a power couple. Why didn't it happen? Was she with the Bagel Boy at the time?
No, Bagel Boy what came later. I would be the hors d'oeuvre. You know, but
the mimosa.
I do believe that that's what went down. I've never told anybody this.
So why didn't it happen? Why didn't surely you guys must have, you know, been interested in each other and attracted to each other.
Yeah, but I've been there with famous people. It's no fun, you know. Mm. Actresses are really popular because they trample over you to get to them, and I couldn't afford the dry cleaning.
Well, tell me what it was like, this one kind of blind speed date that, you know, you had with Cher at her house.
Well, I wrote a sort of a short story about it, which will come in my book, but it was the house, first and foremost, is a palace in Malibu. It's ridiculous. It's like a mansion. It likes, you know, makes these, tycoons look like, you know, they're on the dole, you know. I mean, it's just a massive pad.
I would expect nothing less from Cher.
So we go into the bedroom, the three of us, and the bed is as big as my house. And it all different parts of the bed would move.
Like you it know was what? Like a like sleep.
It was like the leg thing and the head. And there was, and I was getting seasick. I felt.
You were all, wait, were you all three on the bed?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But there were no shenanigans about this, okay. You know, and it was very innocent, really. I was auditioning, to be her boyfriend.
You is what was call. Going did on? Did you get a call back at least?
I no, the money wasn't right.
Did you know you were auditioning when you got in the call?
Oh, come on, John! I know everything.
What could have been? What could have been?
Mikey and Cher. I would have had a comeback.
Yeah. Well, you've had you.
I got you many. Again, babe.
You would have. Well, you would have had a modular bed.
Yeah. No, I have the deepest respect for Cher. Okay. I have the deepest respect for anybody that comes back. You know, because it's a beautiful thing to, like, you know, you have to fight a lot of, you know, it's very difficult to do that, to recreate yourself. Ain't easy. You know?
She did date obviously a lot of famous men besides the Bagel Boy and you know, possibly could have in an alternate universe been you. She dated Gene Simmons, right?
Yeah, she did, you know, and that's really interesting. She dated a couple of friends of mine, Ron Zimmerman, wonderful comedian, writer, little guy, you know, a beautiful guy. You don't have to be like gorgeous in her eyes. She's been with Greg Allman, who is probably one of the most, you know, gorgeous dudes ever, right?
Well, and the reason
it's Sonny Bono, I mean.
Well, the reason I bring this
Sonny
up
was
though,
great. Sonny
is I
was
feel
fantastic.
The
was
reason it? I bring up Gene Simmons, who I know. Wait, did you know Sonny Bono?
Yeah, I want to get into this. Did you know?
I did. I met him a couple of times. Yeah, and I was he was the most. He had the charisma of a really good-looking bloke. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's all about energy.
Yeah.
It's not about, you know, beautiful eyes and fabulous hair and great lips. It's not nothing to do with it. People are more attracted to a positive energy and a loving energy and a compassionate and smart energy. And he had that, really had that. Plus, he had this incredible career. Phil's right-hand man. He learned so much how to make records. He could make great records. He was a great artist. His first single was, you know, what was it called? Don't Like Me or You Hate Me. Or Laugh At Me. And this was his first solo single because he knew that in America he wore a fur vest and they fucking laugh at him. So what does he do? He writes a song called Laugh At Me. Mm-hmm. Massive hit. Brilliant man. Only a brilliant person can think of that. So brilliance is better than, you know, a big penis. And you can...
Well,
write that down.
That's a t-shirt. Well, the reason I brought the Gene Simmons thing though is just to sort of make a segue into the fact that, you know, I know you toured with Kiss, much like AC/DC. Kiss opened for one of your bands at one time, but they opened for Silverhead. Well, that's really cool. But tell me before, the reason I'm bringing up them is they did have a comeback in the 80s that I want to make sure we mention, but tell me what it was like for Kiss to open for Silverhead.
Well, what, you know, me and Johnny Thunders and Nigel Harrison were in the wings in New York. I can't remember the gig, the venue, but we're watching them. We're about to go on Silverhead after Kiss. So we're watching them and the drum starts to go higher and higher on a drum riser. And they looked exquisite, and the blood and the thing and the flames. And Thunders and I just smoked dust, you know, angel dust. And I was on angel dust watching Kiss. This is not a good thing.
It could be. Well, it's probably not a good thing, but it's not a good story. It's a good story.
Oh, it's a great, you know, but to see.
Yeah, a demon.
I mean, yeah. And I'm on dust. I'm going, no. You know, and it was shocking. And we were laughing and everything. And they were fantastic. And I fell in love with all of those boys, Gene and Paul. I loved them. They were great. They were so good to me. And it was a fantastic experience. And then we had to go on and follow them. I'm slipping on the blood, you know.
You're not always good about picking your opening acts, are you?
No. But then again, I have done over 3,000 gigs. You know, sort of with everybody. Well, we've opened for everybody.
Well, so you witnessed that back in the early 70s. So I have to ask how you felt about how they reinvented themselves on 1983. They quite famously took off their makeup on an MTV press conference. It was not the same lineup anymore. They had some, you know, not so successful albums a couple years earlier. They'd done The Elder. It had not gone over well, music from The Elder. And then, you know, they're stripping themselves of their what identifies
Kissness.
Them.
Yeah,
their Kissness.
I think the thing about it was my manager, Danny Goldberg, was managing them, and he gave them the idea because the records weren't selling. And he said, off with the makeup. Let's just be like the metal thing. And then they come out and they realize exactly what these guys look like. These guys are not Tony Curtis.
Paul Stanley is a good
These guys are not Richard Gere. Well, no. Yes, but the hair and the wigs and all of that. I mean, it was... I don't know. It was like somebody seeing somebody naked that didn't look good naked.
Well, to your point then, I thought, and I think a lot of people thought, that it would be, no pun intended, the kiss of death for Kiss to take off their makeup, that this would absolutely be like a career suicide move.
But they had a hit.
But they kind of, I mean, the makeup eventually came back on. But for many years in the 80s, much like Aerosmith, they were adjacent to that hair metal thing, the metal thing that was going on MTV. And they had a lot of hits without makeup in the 80s, you know, like Lick It Up and Forever and X and Sex. They actually became, you know, if you've seen The Decline of Western Civilization Part 2, they were right there, makeup free with all those bands. I definitely did not expect that. I thought, you know, it's like a Samson without his hair situation. You can't have Kiss without their makeup. And yet it was, for a while, very successful.
I don't think they ever put a foot wrong.
Have you heard the music from The Elder?
But even that, you know, was an attempt at something literate and operatic, you know.
I mean, defend The Elder. It's a
boy. I liked it too. I liked it too.
I actually will too, but I don't think the band will defend The Elder.
Absolutely not. But they had a go, didn't they, John? I mean, they had a go, and that was exactly. I liked that. It's good. I sang on his album, Gene's album. I sang on that solo album.
Wait, what?
I sang on Gene's solo album. There I am.
Singing, are you on Radio
Woo! In the background, you know, me and
Which song?
Chrissy Hynde. I don't know the name of the song.
Please tell me it's Radioactive.
I think it had Tonight in the title.
Of course it did.
You know.
It's such a bummer that they had already used the album title Unmasked before they actually guys, no, save that.
But I think they're great, both of them,
really Unmasked this time.
Yeah, really. And then they get COVID, the two of them. I mean,
yeah, you know, but they're doing all right. They're survivors.
They're fine. They're good. They're on the road. They're good. They're doing great. You know, I love those boys. I always will.
So I'm gonna wrap it up with a band that a lot of people think recorded the worst song of all time. Blender magazine decreed it so, but it wasn't an unsuccessful song. They were knee deep in the Hoopla, and somehow Jefferson Starship, also known as Starship, had a huge hit with that song in the 80s with We Built the City. But that wasn't a fluke. They also had like Nothing's Gonna Stop Us from Mannequin. They had
great
Sarah
singer, Mickey Thomas.
The Starship, as they, you know, their curtail name became, like, they became for a little while very big MTV stars. And I don't like We Built This City, but, you know, again, I have, like you, Michael, respect for anyone who can come back or persevere. Yeah. How did that happen? How did, like, Starship become, in 1985, one of the biggest bands on the radio and MTV?
Because Mickey Thomas was an amazing singer. And he was one of the greatest singers I ever heard in my life. He worked with, what was it? Who was it, John, the guitar player?
Artie Kellner?
No. I can't remember, but he really was a great blues singer. He's very like Terry Reid kind of guy. Yeah, great singer. And I think that the song itself was undeniably spectacular.
We Built This City with lyrics by Bernie Taupin. Or you think that's a song that was spectacular? You disagree with Blender saying it was the worst song of all time?
Absolutely. Well, I disagree with everybody. I'm being cryptically stupid here, but the song, yes, anything that's good, anything that's got a melody to it that gets to number one is spectacular. It's so fucking hard to get a hit record, you know, and to write a great song.
What were you saying, John?
That pre-chorus and We Built This City, the Marconi plays the lyrics are stupid. Okay, forget the lyrics. But that ascending pre-chorus is amazing. There's a reason why it went to number one.
It's a great record. They made a great record.
You're thinking of Elvin Bishop.
Elvin Bishop, that's right. Yes. But the thing is that, you know, everybody's made a dumb record. I believe that the Jagger Dave Grohl record was, shall we say, lacking. You know, everybody's capable of like making a bad record and people will get it. The other reverse is true. Anybody who had sung that song would probably, you know, it was so catchy.
Well, it's interesting because I mentioned that Bernie Taupin did the lyrics to that. Yeah. Not his best work. Obviously, he's better known for his stuff with Elton. He also did the lyrics to These Dreams by Heart. So I actually think we really should wrap it up because we haven't talked about Heart. And Heart absolutely had, you know, they have mixed feelings about it now because it was, again, kind of adjacent to that hair metal era. And it was an MTV thing that was an image that they didn't really jibe with. And as you mentioned, you know, when we talked about Aerosmith, Michael, they had outside songwriters. But Heart were so massive in the 80s. They'd had obviously huge success in the 70s too, but they absolutely had to come back in the 80s with, you know, Never and These Dreams and Alone and so many power ballads. And it's kind of an interesting thing. Again, MTV was, for better or worse, very instrumental in that.
Great singer, Diane Warren. You know, you put that together, you're going to have hits, you know. And I think the Ann and Nancy fight, you know, sort of laid that one out, you know. But I have deep respect for both of those women. I think they're extraordinary musicians and singers. And the band was great. Songs were great for that era. You know, I'm listening to, you know, Muddy Waters. It's a different vibe. I'm just being objective and looking at what, you know.
Ann Wilson can sing anything. She's my favorite.
Ann Wilson Pickett is really good, too. I don't know if you've ever heard of Ann Wilson Pickett.
Ann Wilson Pickett. That is a good name for a band. You're coming up with all sorts of great names for bands and T-shirts and stuff. We do need to let you go, Michael. But since I started this podcast by saying, you know, you have had more comebacks and reinventions than almost all the people we just mentioned combined. And you were at the top of the podcast, sort of like giving some sage advice about it, but like, I'm going to let you have the final word. What is the secret to sticking around and having comeback after all these years?
In terms of music?
Yeah.
You gotta love music.
That's it. Love of it is enough.
That's right.
And the rest will follow.
That's right.
I think that is a wonderful way to end this. Thank you so much, Michael.
I love you, Lindsay. Thank you, John. Delightful to be with you. I'll see you both soon, I hope.
Yes, a special thanks to you, Michael. Everybody listening, you can catch Michael Mornings on Little Steven's Underground Garage on SiriusXM and catch his documentary, Who Do You Want Me to Be, on Amazon Prime and streaming platforms. I'm Lindsay Parker. I've also been joined by John Hughes, and we want to thank you for listening. Remember to give us a rate and review on your favorite podcast platform, and we'll catch you next time.
This was Totally 80s, the podcast dedicated to the music of the greatest decade ever. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Totally 80s, and please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Until our next episode, catch you on the flip side.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.